Virginia Prodan was a Romanian lady living under communist rule of the dictator Nicolae Ceausescu. I don't know how many of you know this or not, but Romania was one of the Eastern Bloc countries that after World War II fell under communist rule, but not under the USSR like many of the others around it did. It had its own dictator. He was just as ruthless, just as oppressive as any of the other men coming through government in other communist countries in that area. Nicolae Ceausescu was a tyrant and demanded absolute obedience to his people and frequently would use his position of power to manipulate, abuse people. Being a government that was secular, government that did not encourage religious participation, and so it was not uncommon, as Virginia was growing up, that Christians were imprisoned, beaten, tortured, their buildings and houses confiscated for government property, and all these things that you often hear from people like Ceausescu. Virginia talks about growing up in this kind of an environment, and how it was often that her parents would quietly whisper about the government, how oppressive it was. They were afraid of being caught. They were afraid of somebody hearing them. It was in an era where anybody could accuse anyone of treason, and the government would step in and take them away. And so her parents are always afraid of uttering the truth about their government. And Virginia remembers at a very young age wanting truth, wanting what was real. And so she felt like in her career as she went to go to college that becoming a lawyer would be the best way to stand for truth. She graduated college, became a lawyer, began practicing law, and fell into a government-appointed job, as they often were for young people, a government-appointed job, in defending cases in court from the government. Basically, rubber stamping the government's oppressive regulations through court. It was kind of a mockery at times of the law, and Virginia hated her job. She never felt like she was able to stand for anything that was true. In one particular case that she was managing one time, came across her desk. It was a person who was kind of menial tasks, really concerned about just their property taxes, really nothing special. And the case drug on and on and on. This client kept on coming to see Virginia through the coming weeks. And Virginia was quite honestly getting tired of seeing this person. It was not a very exciting case. But this individual had a sense of enthusiasm about them. He always came in with a smile, always had a pleasant attitude about him. And no matter how long his case took to be dealt with, he never seemed to tire of it. And Virginia remembers one particular day they were sitting across from each other at the desk, and she was just so worn out from this case, and he kept on having this gracious attitude in their meetings. And finally, she couldn't help herself. She just kind of blurted out, "What is it that makes you so happy?" And he smiled, paused, and invited her to church. He couldn't say much about his faith because, as most public conversations go, they were often overheard. And so he invited her to join him that Sunday for church. She hesitated, not knowing exactly if this was a test. Sometimes the government would set up scenarios like this to test a person's loyalty. So she wasn't sure if she was walking into a trap or not, but she decided to go to church that Sunday anyway. And it ended up being a legitimate service. The preacher was preaching on John 14:6. And she remembers him getting out his Bible and opening up and reading, "I am the way, the truth, and the life." She'd never heard anybody talk like this before. She'd grown up kind of around faith, but never really believing anything concrete about God. And so she was enamored, just totally taken by the conversation about the preacher's message, decided to give her life to Christ, became a Christian. Ended up finding more work as a lawyer defending cases of Christians against the government in law and the court system. Obviously putting her directly in the path of this oppressive government. She remembers her tires would often, she would come out of her house on the street to get into her car, and her tires would often be slashed. She was pushed out into traffic at different points. Her children threatened and humiliated. All sorts of kinds of things meant to intimidate her out of her job. But she persisted. And one particular evening, she remembers being getting ready to wrap up at the office, and her assistant came in, the last client that she had to meet with that day. She said, "There's a man outside that wants to see you." All he said was he wants to talk about a case that you're dealing with. She shrugged her shoulders and left. Her assistant was gone for the day. It was just Virginia. Virginia went out to meet this new client. He was a very large man carrying a briefcase. He walked into her office, pulled out a gun, and pointed it at her. Began to explain that the government has been continually warning you about your job and about what you're doing, and you have ignored the warnings, and we're going to take care of this right now. She froze. She didn't know what to do. Obviously, what would you do in those kinds of environments where your life is literally at stake? She prayed a quick prayer as she could only have time for, asking for peace, the words to say, and suddenly she felt an overwhelming sense of peace. And she asked him a question. A boldness came over her. She said, "Have you ever wondered why we're here? Why we exist? What's the purpose of life?" He kind of hesitated for a second, and she noticed she had an opportunity to continue talking. She said, "I believe that all of us have a purpose. I believe that you have a purpose, and I believe that God has put you into a test right now. You're being tested. Are you going to serve the God of heaven, or are you going to serve Nicolae Ceaușescu, your boss, in doing what he has called you to do by killing me today?" He put the gun back into his holster and continued listening. She continued on. She said, "I believe that all of us have fallen short. All of us are messed up. All of us are in need of help and a Savior." And she began sharing with him the message of Jesus. He listened, walked out that day, and she found out later he became a Christian and began preaching the gospel in their government, in their area. I hear stories like this, and I don't know if you've ever heard people give their testimony like that or other stories like that, but it floors me, the power of the message of the gospel. Something that we don't often experience in our culture because of just the easiness with which we are able to worship and lead our lives in America today. But it's not the case for everyone. And I often hear those people talk or hear those stories, and I ask myself the question, what leads a person to be so bold in their faith? To literally be staring down the barrel of a gun in front of someone who's about ready to kill you. To be able to share the message of hope with them, the very person that is trying to take your life, and offer them a chance that you had at redemption. Mark chapter 1 opens the gospel of Mark. And Mark is one of these gospels, unlike many of the others, where he's just kind of working through a bunch of typical scenarios in the life of Jesus. He doesn't spend a whole lot of time on them. But what he says in this chapter is significant, I think, if we're able to stop and think about what he's doing for just a minute. Mark is the first of all the four Gospels that we read. He wrote his Gospel the earliest, as early as the 50s A.D., within 20 to 30 years after Jesus was died and resurrected. Mark writes his Gospel, which is pretty significant if you're ever doing anything with biblical reliability or anything like that. Mark's Gospel likely was written from Peter's account and used as a source for other Gospels. Matthew and Mark probably relied on his material to write their own Gospels. But there's an inscription in the early first century that we have of a church historian talking about how Mark wrote down Peter's story of our Lord. And Mark is well known for being a gospel that jumps from one thing to the other. You often hear as we go forward into our study in Mark, Mark begins and enters stories by saying, "Now immediately this happened, and the next thing, and the next thing, and the next thing." He's not one for a lot of detail. And in fact, he spends very little detail talking about two significant events in Jesus' life in this first chapter, his baptism and his temptation. Spends only a couple verses on each, whereas the other gospel writers spend a chapter or so talking about these events. But Mark's account of Jesus' baptism is still significant. Jesus' baptism has always confused me. And I don't know if you've ever read Jesus, the story of him getting baptized. He goes out into the wilderness. John the Baptist is out there. John was the guy that kind of announced the way for Jesus. And John was out in the wilderness preaching about the gospel, preaching the good news and repentance that this coming kingdom of heaven was coming. And to repent. And he was baptizing in the Jordan River. And Jesus goes out in the wilderness and gets baptized by John. I never understood that. Why would Jesus be baptized? What does he need from baptism? Obviously, he's not in a situation like we are, where he needs forgiveness or anything like that. And in fact, Matthew, in his account of Jesus' baptism, John asks Jesus the same question. What are you doing here? I should be baptized by you, and you want to be baptized by me? And Jesus' response in that story in Matthew is significant. He says, we need to do this to fulfill all righteousness. It's likely Jesus is doing a couple things in his baptism. He's foreshadowing his coming death, the purpose for his whole being, to come to seek and to save the lost. He's fulfilling the prophecies of the Messiah that had been given to the Jewish people for generations, and he's identifying with us, our sinful state and our need of baptism. But if you read the story, as we were hearing it read this morning, the events are miraculous. I mean, just think about this for a second. You're a Jewish person. You're observing this preacher give his message, and all of a sudden this guy comes out of nowhere and says, I want to be baptized. And so they go down into the water, and all of a sudden, after this man is baptized, there's this bright light from heaven. The skies are open. And this dove comes out of nowhere and lands on this person, Jesus. And then there's this voice, this is my son, in whom I am well pleased. I mean, talk about a kickoff to a ministry, right? Jesus uses this event and begins his ministry at his baptism. And I couldn't think of a better way to kick off ministry like that. When I was in youth ministry, we always wanted to... Whenever you do anything with teens, you have to make it good, right? Because it's always got to grab them. It's got to catch their attention. And teens are notorious for having a million things to do and a million different directions they could go in their brain. And so you try to pull them in. And one of the big events that we used to do every year was a lock-in. I hated lock-ins. Oh my goodness, I hated lock-ins. Anybody ever worked a lock-in before? Yes. And all those who just raised their hand went... Because you know, as an adult, right? As a teen, I loved lock-ins. They were great. As an adult, I'm like, can we just sleep? Like, 2 hours? Like, can we have nap time somewhere in this schedule? You know? For some reason, that's a big event for teens. The thing that cracked me up was this. You know, they wanted to stay up all night, but then by 5 a.m., they're all asleep anyway. Didn't make sense. But anyway, weak is what I called it. So we would always start this night together with a big event, you know? Honestly, to be honest with you, I always started the night with a big event going somewhere else because I didn't want to have to entertain them at the church building for 4 hours that it would take to go somewhere. So we always went somewhere to begin with. And it was usually a fun event, bowling or something like laser tag we would go. And one particular lock-in, I remember, I found this place in Columbus called Sky Zone. Anybody ever heard of Sky Zone? You know? Sky Zone. It's this big indoor trampoline park. Okay, wall to wall. Think of a humongous building, right? As big as our property, maybe, out here and around the parking lot. You know, I don't know how, 20-foot tall ceilings and wall-to-wall trampolines. I mean, I'm telling you, it's massive. And they had different places you could jump, a ball pit or different things to do with trampolines. And so I thought, this would be great. You know, we'll go to Sky Zone, we'll have a fun time, we'll come back and we'll start the evening tonight. I totally underestimated the amount of energy it takes to jump on a trampoline. You ever jumped on a backyard trampoline for a little bit, like 15 minutes? You're exhausted, right? I got this place for 2 hours. I thought, oh, this would be perfect. You know, we'll tire them out. We'll get them all ready to go. 30 minutes, and they were done. 30 minutes was it. And they were all like, can we go home now? I'd never been in an environment where they wanted to go back so quickly as this Sky Zone deal. It was a flop. It was terrible. It was an awful kickoff to the evening. But Jesus kicks off his ministry in a way that perhaps no one else could. But the reality is, Jesus knows what's coming next. He knows that it's not always going to be fireworks. It's not always going to be this amazing display of God's confirmation on His mission. Because the very next thing Mark records, and every gospel records this, the very next thing Jesus does is He walks out into the wilderness for 40 days to be tempted. And Jesus spends the next month and a half, nearly, without food, tempted 3 different times by the devil, experiencing fatigue, exhaustion, frustration, anything that you could think of that would come up after that long without having nourishment. And in direct contrast to the baptism that always kind of confused me, I never seemed to have that problem with Jesus' temptation. I always felt like I understood what that was about. Because unlike His baptism, His temptation always comforted me. The fact that Jesus was tempted like I am. And it makes Him more relatable to us. Hebrews chapter 4 talks about this. That we don't have a high priest, Jesus, who is unable to sympathize with us in our weakness, but in every way was tempted as we are, and yet without sin. Jesus spends this much time in the desert alone to relate to us in our need for help. And something hit me this week as I was trying to think about how to tie these events in together and what is significant about these two things put right together in the first chapter of Mark. Something hit me in verses 14 and 15, and I want to share this with you. And I'm way behind on my slides at this point, so you'll have to forgive me as I try to catch up. It says this, 14 and 15. Now after John was arrested, Jesus came into Galilee proclaiming the gospel of God. And saying, the time is fulfilled, the kingdom of heaven of God is at hand. Repent and believe in the gospel. Now this is the first time that Jesus has said anything about the gospel, okay? This is the first mention that He's ever made about good news, about His kingdom coming, about His message and His ministry and what He's about to do in His life of the next 3 years. And I was asking, why is Jesus at this point now talking about the gospel? And I believe it's this. Jesus preached the gospel because He'd seen the gospel. Jesus is able at this point in His life to preach good news because He's seen good news. Not that He needed the good news like we need it. Obviously, He's the Son of God. He doesn't need to be saved like we are. And yet, through His baptism, through His temptation, Jesus, the Son of God, is able to see hope and the good news of the gospel. Jesus has experienced deliverance. He's been baptized. He's been confirmed in His ministry by the Father. This voice from heaven, this angel, this dove coming out of heaven, resting on Him, fulfilling all the prophecies. And then He goes out into the wilderness and spends the next month and a week seeing the provision, deliverance of God in the desert. I don't know if you caught this, but Mark mentions that He was in the desert with the wild animals. Jesus' life was literally at stake in the desert. You ever been in the middle of nowhere around dangerous animals? If you've ever hunted before in dangerous territory, you know how dangerous this can be. Jesus is hungry, right? He doesn't have any food and water. He's probably feeling and looking like He's going to die. The buzzards are circling, right? He was with the wild animals, and yet it says that the angels were ministering to Him. God provides and gives Him deliverance. He knew what the gospel could do. He knew what good news was because He knew what the other side was like. He knew what our need was as people. Need of deliverance. Need of hope. And in fact, He even mentions this in His prayer, the Lord's Prayer. What does He say? Lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. Jesus preached the gospel because He'd seen the gospel. You cannot preach the gospel if you've never experienced the gospel. Jesus' experience uniquely equipped Him at this point in His life, unlike no other point, to be able to know what this good news was that he was preaching. And my concern for the church, for us, is this. Many of us have not fully experienced the gospel. We've been saved, but we haven't been converted. And there are two different things, really, when you get down to it. Being saved is, I'm on my way to heaven. I know I have trust and I have faith that God will deliver me. At the end of my life, I'm with Him in heaven. We have security in knowing that Christ's blood has washed us from our sin. That is, there is no question about that. But converted is one step further. It's knowing you are on your way to heaven and washed by the blood, but we want everybody to know about it. It's a conversion of my mindset. A mental shift in how I live, what I do, how I act, and the urgency with which I live my faith. If you watch Jesus from now on, He is on a mission. He has His face set towards Jerusalem. He knows what He's doing. He has no question in His life about the urgency that He has. He has 3 years to do this. And then it's all over. The biggest criticism that you often will hear of the world towards Christians is this, that we don't act any differently. And in so many ways, they're right. And if this is true, if we don't act any differently, in their perspective, this affects my ability to share the message of Christ, the message of hope with them, right? Because if nothing is different about my life, who would want to be a part of what I have? Nobody wants to be a part of something whose lifestyle or people live no differently than they already do. Why bother? And on our side, if we act no differently, we have lost the urgency in the message of hope that we have. Because who wants to share something that really didn't change you anyway? I don't know if you've ever talked on the phone. It seems like you get a million calls in a week from telemarketers. You ever pick up one and just kind of goof with them a little bit? You know, come on, be honest, you do. It's fun. You know, one of the things that I think is hilarious at times about, and to be honest, I feel bad for these people because they're just doing their job. They're trying to pay bills like you and I are. We could talk about their choice of job, but they're just trying to pay bills. But I always think it's interesting. Every now and then you get a person on the phone that they talk with the enthusiasm of Eeyore. You know? You ever talk with one of these people? It's like they're reading the script, they're going through the motion, and let me tell you about this new product that we have. It can change everything about the way you live your life, and I would love to tell you more about this. Would you like to know about our new offer? And you're just like, wait a second. This is terrible advertising, right? There's no enthusiasm in that. Who wants to buy it? I'm trying to think about how I can get off the phone as quickly as possible, right? Who wants to buy that? So what gives? How do I get this urgency in my life? How do I get this sense of mission that is in Jesus' life? It was in Virginia's life and what she said to that person in her office that evening. How do I get this? You have to be won by the gospel to win with the gospel. While Jesus didn't need the Son of God, or didn't need the gospel as the Son of God, he saw the power of God clearly working in his life. The confirmation of his mission at his baptism, angels ministering to him, saving him in the wilderness, Jesus knew this was legit, this was real. And I want to ask you a question this morning. Have you seen the gospel working in your own life? Have you dealt with yourself? I think one of the biggest tragedies of our lives as Christians is that we've somehow divorced this, what we do right here behind me, this baptism act, with our lives and what we do after we sit in a pew every week. We think that we're fine now, right? We've done it. We've done our due diligence. We've been baptized and that's it. We don't need to worry. We're just waiting now to be taken home. That's not the message of the gospel. The message of the gospel is ongoing sanctification, ongoing change and progress in my life, that my life should be continually shaped by the message and into the image of Christ. And so, in 10 years, my life should look different. In 20 years, my life should look different. If you're sitting here after 20, 30, 40 years of being a Christian, and you're the same person that you were that many years ago, there's a problem. Who wants that? And I'm not trying to knock you. Please, don't hear me wrong. I understand it's easy to do. It's so easy to do, and that's why there's so many of us doing it. And yet that will never get us anywhere in a conversation with somebody who desperately needs the hope that we have because they don't see the urgency. They don't see the need. Verse 14 says, after John was arrested, Jesus came into Galilee proclaiming the gospel of God. It's interesting that it was right after John's arrest that Jesus begins preaching. He understood that time is short. He understood he was in a spiritual battle, that people would put him in prison, would kill him for this. And he didn't have enough time to do what he needed to do. He'd seen the other side. He knew what was coming, the battle that was at stake and at play. And I believe all of us have to have these deep, dark secrets and past lives that we come out of to become Christians, right? I think it's always great when you hear somebody's testimony of the life that they lived before Christ, and it was full of addiction or all these terrible things, and then they came to Christ and all of it was gone. Not all of us need that or have that. But all of us should have an understanding of the battle that we are in, of light and darkness. To be able to say, I was a servant of evil before I came to Christ. I may not have known that at the time. I may not have done all the dark deeds of the evil one, but I knew, I can tell you, I was lost before I met Christ. Because knowing the battle gives us urgency. There's a story in the book of Acts that is told at the first in the first few chapters, and it ultimately becomes the focus of the rest of the book. It's a story about a man named Saul. Saul was this Hebrew scholar, religious leader, zealous for his faith, probably passionate as anybody ever was in what he believed. And he believed that his duty in life was to get rid of this scourge, this heresy called Christianity, the way, as they called it. And so he sought out Christians, those early years in Acts, putting them in prison, killing them, taking them and getting rid of them. Until one day, he met Jesus on the road to Damascus. And those of you who are familiar with the story, hang with me, because I know you're familiar with it, but don't miss it. He meets Jesus on the road to Damascus. He's a vision of the Christ right there. He says, why are you persecuting me, Saul? Makes him blind. Causes him to question everything about what he thought God was or who God was. Eventually, Paul is converted to Christianity. His name changes to Paul and becomes the greatest missionary there ever was for Christ. Listen to what he says in 2 Corinthians chapter 10, one of the letters that he writes to one of the churches he plants. We do not boast, this is 2 Corinthians 10, 15 and 16. We do not boast beyond our limit in the labors of others. But our hope is that as your faith increases, our area of influence among you may be greatly enlarged, so that we may preach the gospel in lands beyond you. So that we may preach the gospel in lands beyond you without boasting of work already done in another's area of influence. If you read all of Paul's letters, you come away with this very real sense, as he mentions it, that his vision was to go to Spain for the gospel. It wouldn't have been called Spain for Paul, but that's where he was talking about. He wanted to go to the farthest reaches, which in Paul's day was the end, the other end of the world that he knew. He wanted to do that because he knew his time was short. He didn't have long. And his life counted and what he did with it. Paul had a sense of urgency because, one, he'd seen the gospel working in his own life. He'd seen his transformation, as he often called himself, the chief of sinners. Total 180 from darkness to light. He'd seen the gospel work in his own life, and he'd seen the other side. He knew the battle that was being waged. This morning, do you have a sense of urgency? If this was your last week here, who would walk away from your life knowing about Christ because of what you've done in your life up until this point? Jesus proclaims the gospel because he'd seen the gospel. Have you seen the gospel in your own life? If not, why not? In a moment, John's going to come and lead us in another song. We're going to sing and stand as we always do, and would invite you to respond if you need to, publicly, of course, but privately if you need to as well. And please, let us know how we can help you in your walk with the Lord. Come as we stand and sing if you need.